Sport and the Law on Breakfast with Vossi and Brandy. For Bryden's Lawyers, let our team of professionals help with your legal matter.
Morning, Lee.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning, Andrew. A pleasure as always.
What's in store for Anzac Day for Lee Hadjipantelis?
Football. There'll be three games, I think, are being broadcast live on Fox. So I'm looking forward to that. The family usually gathers on a Thursday night. The eldest two who are married come over, and the youngest and her partner. So it'll be family night and watching the football.
We're so lucky to have you on speed dial. It's been a very busy 24 hours, Lee. The one that we've spoken about more today on the program, but we want to get a couple of big rugby league linked stories. First of all, Braden Trindall, the DUI, the failed roadside illicit drugs test. First of all, just for those, because there'd be a lot of people listening who haven't been in that position. What happens there with that? Are they're two separate tests? Is the illicit drugs test done on the spot, or is that done back at the police station? And then a second sample, is that the same test but tested twice? How does the process work?
Now, if you are pulled over and you're tested, whether it's breathalyzer or drug test, it's done on the side of the road. And, of course, if you return a positive result, you will be arrested. You will then be conveyed to a police station where a second sample will then be taken and sent away for testing. But you are, in fact, placed under arrest immediately you test positive on the side of the road. So that's what would have happened. Back at the station, he would have blown, it is reported that he's blown 0.124, I think it is, which is a mid-range reading. And of course, these are all just allegations at the moment. He's presumed to be innocent until such time as whether he pleads guilty or found guilty by a court of law. But the allegation is that he blew at the station 0.124, and they have sent off the oral test for confirmation of the roadside finding of the illicit drug.
So they wouldn't know that yet. No one knows that yet. Is that right?
Yes, the second oral fluid test has yet to confirm the original reading on the side of the road, which would have shown positivity to cocaine. But then you have an oral fluid test, and the results of that would not be known as yet.
Okay, and then not the specifics of this case, but then how does that then normally take its course? If you have a person appearing before the courts who it is factual that they have over the limit when they've proven positive to an illicit substance, are the court cases then cut and dried as to how long they run, like bang, guilty, guilty? How does it work?
Invariably, the facts are presented, and unless there are grounds to challenge those facts, it's very, very difficult to contest these sorts of charges because the police and the police laboratories and the testing of now is just so sophisticated, it's very hard to find any fault as such. But having said that, I would remind you and your listeners of the Josh Reynolds case where the second test showed that the first recorded a false positive. So there is always that possibility. But getting back to your point, though, Andrew, in court, you need to find grounds to challenge those readings, and that's incredibly difficult to say there's a break in the chain of causation or, you know, between where the test was taken and the testing of it. The majority of those cases would result in a plea of guilty, and then there would be some contrition shown and the court would be asked to extend some discretion so far as the penalties are concerned. But in order to challenge, to plead not guilty, you would need not an affirmative case as such, because the onus, of course, still rests with the prosecution, but it wouldn't be a difficult case for them to establish based on the testing unless you could show some flaw in the testing or some error made.
Now, the Sharks and NRL Integrity Unit, their role in this process, we've certainly had precedents on drink driving, but I can't remember a current player, Lee, that has gone both drink driving and drug driving.
At the same time, yeah, that's correct.
At the same time.
Yeah. Well, obviously, it's come to the attention of the NRL Integrity Unit. The Sharks have done the right thing by reporting it immediately. They'll take an interest in this, and they'll sit back at the moment, though, and they will await the results of the court proceedings. Interesting to know whether or not he will be stood down pending those proceedings or not. The NRL sometimes takes an ambivalent position until such time as the matter has been dealt with by the courts. It doesn't infringe the automatic stand-down policy, given the potential penalties involved. So it'll be interesting to see what the NRL does. However, another interesting note is that if he is found, and it's a big if, but if he is found guilty of driving with an illicit drug, Does that become relevant then from the NRL's illicit drug policy perspective, or is it just simply a matter of bringing the game into disrepute? And the answer is, it is not relevant for the government, for the governing body's illicit drug policy, because it is not an official WADA test. And the WADA rules require that testing occur on the day of competition. So the fact that if he is found guilty of driving with an illicit drug, the NRL will not be able to rely upon that to invoke their illicit drugs policy, but they will simply treat it as being a grounds of bringing the game into disrepute and will treat it as such.
Okay, we'll watch how this one plays out. Now, the other story developing today, young Canterbury forward Jackson Taupany has launched legal proceedings against the Bulldogs amid allegations that a punishment he was forced to endure over being late for training was a deprivation of liberty and unlawful corporal punishment.
Well, I think we all saw this one coming. We haven't seen the statement of claim as yet, but it is a matter of public record, so it'll become available. But there is reporting as to what it contains. Now, we've spoken previously about the relationship that exists between an NRL player and the club. It is one of employee and employer. The employer owes the NRL player a duty of care, often regarded as the highest duty of care that exists. And if there is a breach of that duty of care, which results in injury, loss or damage, then proceedings in negligence can be brought. And that's what's occurred here. But what's more interesting, though, is the reporting as to some of the counts that are being relied upon, including deprivation of liberty and unlawful corporal punishment. Now, these are what we would refer to as intentional torts. An intentional tort occurs when someone makes a deliberate or purposeful choice to act or fail to act in a certain way which causes harm, distinguished from negligence, which is the breach of duty of care. So they've pleaded these intentional torts as well, which can result in very significant damages, punitive, exemplary damages, and the like. So they've obviously pleaded this case high, wide and handsome. It'd be interesting to see how the Bulldogs respond to this. Now, these cases will ultimately resolve by way of mutual agreement or alternatively be determined by the courts before a judge of the Supreme Court, who will hear evidence as to what occurred on the day. There will be witness testimony from others that were present. But most importantly, there will be expert evidence available from people appropriately qualified to comment as to whether what occurred on the day was appropriate or inappropriate, and whether or not it establishes a breach of duty of care by the club.
Boy, that could get messy if players are called to court to give evidence on what they thought about what happened. That could be very uncomfortable for a player,
for
the club, and a professional sports person is, you know, employed obviously. In terms of league, by the club, but surely the rules are a little bit different for a professional sports player than just your average worker.
Yes.
So that's absolutely right, and so that will be the standard of care. Now, the Civil Liability Act provides that in the case of establishing negligence, you look at what they call peer professional opinion, what other clubs do, for example, what other experts say. You're right, you have to compare apples with apples, and the players giving witness testimony, Greg, would be more likely to say what they saw and heard on the day as opposed to what they think.
What their opinion was.
Establishing the factual bottom line as to what the facts were, and then allow them, the experts, to come in and deal with that.
Well, as I said, we're lucky to have you, Lee, to be able to explain all of this and the process. And these two stories are going to be covered, the Trindle one quicker than the Taupany one. But they are big stories. In the course of a rugby league year, all these things happen every week. The news cycle of rugby league keeps churning out stories, and sadly, a lot of them need some legal advice, and we get it from you, Lee. And for everyone listening right now, if they need legal advice, your Brighton's Lawyers team is on hand, ready to provide that service.
Thank you, gentlemen. Always a pleasure. Have a great day.
Lee Hadjipantelis there. Principal of Brighton's Lawyers, the best legal advice. We encourage you to put this number in your phone, so if you ever need any sort of legal help, the number is 1-800-848-848.
Sport and the Law on Breakfast with Bossy and Brandy. For Brighton's Lawyers, let our team of professionals help with your legal matter.